It's time once again. Thanks for joining us again on this Friday, at least we're recording it on Friday, for DC Signal to Noise. I'm Farm Journal News Director John Harith, and over there is Jim Wiesmeyer, Washington, D.C. analyst for Pro Farmer, the guy with the pitchfork to separate the fertilizer from the hay, if you might, from what we get out of Washington, D.C. Is that a good way to describe it, Jim?
Well, at least we try. It's, as Dick Lang, former Ag Secretary, used to say when he went into a barn, he saw a lot of stuff around, and he said, "Where's the horses?"
Good observation. Well, let's see if maybe we can find the horses this week on DC Signal to Noise. Jim, let's start off with some news you had earlier this morning for subscribers of your Pro Farmer newsletter. There are some developments now on a meeting between President Trump and President Xi of China. We may actually see some movement forward.
Well, there's hope now, and I think that's what agriculture needs right now. Post some harvest time and lower prices, we need some trade aspects. And we first saw it with some Chinese official comments both before and after their subdued GDP report for the third quarter. Although it jumped to 6.5%, that was down from 6.8% in the first half of this year, and they were having to condition their citizens there. And one of the areas that a Chinese official talked about was ongoing trade talks with U.S. officials. Then the South China Morning Post, pretty good newspaper, said that they've tentatively agreed, both Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping have tentatively agreed to meet November 29th. That's just ahead of the Group of 20 summits, summit in Buenos Aires, Argentina. So I think at the best if they formally meet, I think that that's a very good sign, because when two leaders meet, they want some positive news coming out of any discussion.
Yeah, and while announcement of a meeting is not necessarily a deal, it is positive for the reason you just mentioned, for the reason that the markets could see that as a positive, especially if it comes on the heels of, as you've hinted at before, a late-year announcement that President Trump is going to roll back the tariffs on metals.
Yeah, in fact, next week I'm going to be looking for maybe more concrete information. We were told about midweek this week that the White House was looking for dates and locations to really take the afterglow of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, USMCA, the update of the NAFTA agreement. But before that can happen, and if they want Canadian and Mexico, Mexican officials at that event, and they probably do, those metal tariffs are going to have to be lifted. So if you hear a bona fide date and location of where Trump wants to announce, information, to me, that's very good news, because the pork market, the corn market, the dairy market is all looking for those tariffs that have been placed by Mexico and some tariffs by Canada on U.S. farm products. There would be a timeline for those to be lifted as well, John.
Now, we had the deal announced between the United States, Mexico, and Canada, but pursuing a deal with China is a very different beast. With U.S., Mexico, and Canada, it was kind of fine-tuning what was already there. With China, we've really got some fundamental changes that need to be made in the way trade is structured between the two countries. Can that get done?
Well, it can get done, but boy, I think it's going to be done in pieces. Because of the complexity, as you said, in the intellectual property area, in some of the rather significant structural changes that U.S. officials, including Trump, want China to do, and whether or not they'll go along is still a significant unknown answer. They're not going to come, all that willing to change, the structure of their, country, and frankly, I don't blame them in that regard. I'll tell you what the traders are going to watch out for. Any meeting between Trump and Xi, and the odds would go up if they hear favorable comments about the potential not only of the meeting, but getting an agreement if U.S. Trade Representative Bob Lighthizer cast a positive tone on it rather than a potential negative. And I think they're waiting for him to make a statement on this, because this meeting has really been being pushed by the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and the National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow. Now, that doesn't mean that they're effective. They're not effective, but I'll tell you, it's Lighthizer and Peter Navarro, the trade advisor, who rule the roost and has Trump's ears on the U.S.-China trade relations.
Yeah, but as you point out, it seems Steve Mnuchin that seems to be keep pushing the boundaries in the background on where the talks are going. What is driving his interest in this?
Well, I think, you know, being practical, pragmatic, a market-oriented person, he knows that both sides are losing right now. We had former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan say this week in an interview with Barron's, nobody wins in a trade war. And he's absolutely right. They're taxes. And if Trump abhors taxes, and I know he does, there have been taxes put on a host of products from both countries. So, you know, Mnuchin as a financial person knows this. And I think he's also not worried. He wants to see the U.S. economy continue to be a rather robust market, especially relative to the other industrialized countries. And to do that, or to increase the odds of that, John, is with improved trade relations with China. We saw some negatives late this week when USDA reported Friday some cancellations of soybean sales. Now, not only to China, but unknown destinations, and frequently that is China. So that was the negative news. So it'll be curious to see over the next few trading sessions, especially early next week, what side the trade goes on. Is this another negative in the hole called the soybean market, or will they think, maybe the Trump G meeting will come off after all?
All right, well, while we're on trade, Jim, let's talk about a couple of ancillary issues that may impact trade. Let's start with the president's comments on Twitter today and elsewhere, indicating that he may close off the border with Mexico because of this caravan of immigrants headed from Honduras through Mexico up headed towards the United States. If the president takes that action and follows through, what does that do with the relationship with Mexico and with the fate of the newly negotiated U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement?
Well, he's even threatened to cancel, I guess, the Mexico portion of the USMCA. Now, he's got a clear history there of threatening to either walk away and having not done so. The only one he did walk away from was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that was a major, major mistake his third day in office.
And now he's walking back to it, but...
Yes. I don't think he's going to do that. But, yeah, he is clearly threatening military action, which means around the border, not going into Mexico. And he's also signaled not only to Mexico, but a host of Honduras and other countries that they would get much reduced U.S. aid, if any. So he's huffing and puffing there because they know that this is a growing issue going into November 6th elections. In fact, he also said that immigration policy was more important to him and building the wall than trade policy. Now, that shows you where his interests clearly lie. Now, will that happen? I think he's sending signals in our signal to noise moniker here that he's giving Mexico's officials a clear shot that they better help out in this regard. Now, Mexico went to the United Nations for some assistance here, so hopefully reasoned issues will come into play here.
Well, and to a certain degree, it does have a valid point of why Mexico is allowing this to cross two of their borders to become the problem for the U.S.
Oh, absolutely. And he knows that this, it gets into national security and it gets into flagrant. You talk about illegal open borders. There's one thing to call for open borders within some sensible policy of immigration, allowed immigration, but to have illegal open borders is just flaunting it. I don't know why this is galvanizing right now. I'm not going to cast blame like some people have in trying to tie it to the November 6th elections by a certain party. There's just no evidence of this right now. But I will tell you, immigration issue is a key one when you talk to election year experts, especially on the Republican voting side and some independents. So this is why this is such an important issue, not only from a policy, but from an election year issue.
Yeah, definitely. Jim, another area where we're seeing international intrigue that could or could not impact U.S. trade is the growing tensions with Saudi Arabia over the alleged killing of a Washington Post columnist at the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey. Is there exposure for U.S. agriculture in this growing tension there?
Well, there's a growing exposure there because it is a very complex issue. And just the Middle East, I mean, that tells you which is the corridor of the shipping, sector. Not saying anything will happen on that, but on energy prices, if this thing escalates in the negative tone, what action Saudi Arabia could take that could really, bull the crude oil, prices higher. That could trip the U.S. economy into a very growth recession, if not total recession. And it also shows the significance. And I hope the renewable fuels industry, especially ethanol industry, takes heed of this. This shows you the significance of the long-term significance of having a viable renewable fuels policy in this great country. Because while we're not independent, we're not oil energy independent, this bolsters the case of those who are supporting increasing the use of corn-based ethanol, not decreasing. It bolsters the case of those wanting higher blends, year-round E15, and even higher blends to temper some of the potential negatives if Saudi Arabia would take action. Now, as the week went on, President Trump got more reserved, if that's the right word for him, in his comments regarding Saudi Arabia. This is, of course, a delicate issue. And Pompeo, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, went over there. He's briefing the president. And Trump has said that there are going to have to be significant sanctions. You've got lawmakers from both sides of Capitol Hill saying there should definitely be significant reaction to Saudi Arabia. So once the investigation ends, and it's been a while now, I think we know the information, we'll see what those sanctions will be, and then the markets are going to turn to Saudi Arabia's reactions. It's a fine line here relative to a very strategic ally. It's called Saudi Arabia, but the delicacy of trying to weave that into what Trump always says, we don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot because of all the economic indications of implications of working with Saudi Arabia. You talk about a dilemma. This is how it's spelled right there, Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, but how much leverage do they hold over oil prices at this moment? Because one, while the U.S. isn't totally fuel independent yet, we are much more so than we were even a decade ago, and we become more so the higher oil prices go because it makes oil from fracking more economically feasible. You mentioned E15 and the increased market share that can take from renewable fuels. You combine that with the fact that other OPEC nations likely would not follow along with Saudi Arabia in an oil supply change at this moment based on the dispute over this killing. So how much leverage does Saudi Arabia have right now?
They've got a big leverage. It's like in baseball, since it's World Series time or close to it, it's like taking your third, fourth, and fifth player out of the lineup. It will have an impact. And you saw it with, although some of the, I thought, rather hyper comments from some energy analysts that says you could have, that said you could have energy prices go to $400 a barrel. Well, you know, let's get to 100 first. So I don't think it would be that significant, but, you know, they're a mighty mouse still when it comes to the oil industry. So I don't buy into that we wouldn't see significant implications if this were to be the case where Saudi Arabia would want to flex its muscles. Now, to be very fair here, Saudi Arabia needs the U.S. because it's a tinderbox over there in the Middle East. And for decades, we've had both Democratic and Republican presidents working with the Saudi leadership. But now this is just raw meat exposed. How high in the Saudi Arabia kingdom did this go? Or were these outside the mainstream of the kingdom officials? I think that remains to be seen. Above and beyond the hypiness that we've seen in the press on this issue as well.
And strategically, the U.S. needs Saudi Arabia, especially with the increasing stability in Turkey and our main base being there in insular Turkey.
Iran, too.
We definitely need that strategic location.
There are no ifs, ands, or buts. So, but this is the dilemma that Trump and the U.S. Administration has been dealt with. So it's, you know, there's no right answers here. So you have to react, but it's who do you react to, and to what degree. And so this is going to unfold as we go into next week, because I think some of these pronouncements will be made, and the markets, will be sensitive to it, not only in energy, but in the ag-related markets because of the significant input called energy.
All right. Well, Jim, let's turn to the Farm Bill. This week, AgriTalk had Colin Peterson, who is the ranking Democrat on the House Agriculture Committee and also one of the four leaders involved in the negotiations over the conference committee for the Farm Bill, trying to find agreement between the House and Senate versions. And Chip Flory, host of AgriTalk, asked Congressman Peterson about an update of where the Farm Bill stands. And even though they're beyond the deadline that they saw, they're still talking fairly aggressively and getting something done. Here's what Congressman Peterson had to say.
Our staff is working, every day on every title. We've got three of those titles pretty much done, and we're making progress, but it's slow. It's slower than I would like to see it, but, we came out of our last face-to-face meeting united with a strategy, and that is to get this stuff wrapped up over the next few weeks so that we've got a bill drafted, scored, and ready to go the week after we get back from the election, which is the second week after the election. So that's the plan. We're not there yet. We're still hung up on some stuff in the commodity title, still some hung up on some of the conservation stuff. Mm-hmm. And obviously the SNAP issue, doesn't seem to be getting really any place significant.
So, Jim, that says to me this is going to be, they're hoping this will be wrapped up by staff because the principals are going to be out on the campaign trail.
Yeah, well, that's usually how it's done anyway. And I'll tell you, the Farm Bill staff for both sides of the aisle in both chambers are always good, and especially now. I know more than a few of them, and they can get the job done. But it is going to have to be signed off on at the highest level with these four principals on some of these dicey areas that the former chairman of the House Ag Committee, Colin Peterson, said. But you just heard the practical side side of Colin Peterson. He had to go through a conference when he chaired the House Ag Committee, so he knows what needs to be done. Now, when I heard him say the week they get back, the week after, they'll wait for the scoring of some of these compromises, as I heard him, that they've worked out to be scored to see if they fit within the parameters of the spending totals in the farm bill. So we're looking still several weeks after Congress comes back in the middle of November before we would have a floor vote. But I think he gave the strategy there of, number one, they're talking. Two, staffs is probably going to handle 95% of the issues, and then the four principals will sign off on the last 5%. And that's the way it should be, at least we're at that juncture.
Now, I find it interesting that in listening to the former chairman, the ranking member there, Colin Peterson, talk about strategy moving forward on getting this farm bill through, that you've got a Democratic Party that seems to be fairly well convinced that they are going to gain a majority in the House. If you ask some of them, they may think they're going to at least make some gains in the Senate, but probably not a majority. But in listening to Colin Peterson, the ranking Democrat in this on the House side in this process, you don't hear him talking about taking advantage of that post-election and seeking any sort of change, which I find kind of interesting.
Well, he knows that. What do you gain from waiting until a new Congress, even though his party and he himself could be the House Ag Committee chairman? You don't really gain that much, if anything. Reason? The issues would remain the same. Now, they wouldn't have the thrust of the food stamp program, so maybe that would make it easier, but definitely not easy, because on the Republican side, you would have a different tone by some of the conservatives in the Republican Party to really fight a lot of things on the eventual return of a farm bill to the House floor. Colin knows all this. He's been through this. He's a seasoned veteran. He wants to get it through. And recall that Colin worked very closely with the House Ag Committee Chairman Mike Conaway in the writing of most other titles other than food stamps in the farm bill. So he signed off, if you will, under a potpourri of these issues, including the commodity title. So I think Colin is on the side of some of these improvements that most people say is embodied in the House farm bill that is being fought by some on the Senate side because of the lack of money, and you have to take a little here to get improvements in both, not just limited to the price loss coverage program, but also the ag risk coverage program. But without new money, you have to take from other areas, and that's the sensitivity, I think, that he talked about in Title I. But I was positive when I heard Colin's comments, because he is an important player in this debate, because he can move a number of key Democrats along when it eventually gets to the House floor.
Yeah, and while he sounded positive there about a timeline, then just a few minutes later, he threw out a potential very significant barrier that gets to your point about fighting over dollars. Here's what Colin Peterson had to say about how the hurricanes we've seen recently may throw a big wrench in the farm bill process.
I think you're going to see, when we get back after the election, a lot of pressure from members that are in that hurricane area to try to add something either to the farm bill or to the appropriations or something to try to deal with that could potentially give us more problems to solve than we already have. So we'll just have to see how that plays out.
So, yeah, Jim, we could see, as you said, the dollars are finite there, even though we seem to borrow willy-nilly to get there. There could be a big fight coming after the election to try to get that relief for those who were impacted by the hurricanes.
Well, unless the leadership specifies that any additional disaster aid fund must have budget offsets, they frequently do not do that, maybe a part of it. But it's usually off budget, in meaning they don't have to find budget offsets, which adds to the deficit, which adds to the overall debt. But in fact, I think that this could increase the chances of a farm bill when they return, because either if they link additional funding on the Farm Bill measure, or the Republican leadership could talk to House members saying, you know, we want to get this Farm Bill through, and we also want to get disaster aid assistance done to the very needy. I mean, and it's growing. So they could link some of the support for both measures in it. So I'm not as negative on this development. I think that this will push Congress in both the House and the Senate to resolution, both on a needed Farm Bill, but definitely on the need for additional disaster assistance, because you saw Ag Secretary Sonny Perdue this week saying he urged lawmakers to do something similar to what they did, up to $2.4 billion in the recent hurricanes, you know, that hit those southeast states, what, in 2017. So, again, I'm more that this will not stop the forward progress of the positive news that we're hearing, at least on the Farm Bill talks. You know, Congress, that's one of their roles to help out when truly needed. And if you saw the pictures, it was pretty devastating, because it was such a shock that it came in so quick and at a much higher rate on the level gauge than, you know, was anticipated.
And a lot of that need is in agriculture.
Absolutely, from pecans to cotton to tomatoes to the vegetables to the hog industry, poultry, etc. Yeah, agriculture just has been hit by so much the last few years that there's widespread support in both political aisles, both chambers, for additional assistance, and they should get it.
All right, Jim, anything else we should be watching from this week in the Farm Bill discussions?
Well, you had, you know, relative to the Farm Bill, well, actually the, you know, the trade assistance, you know, package, the National Cotton Council, and we'll be talking about this and writing about it on ProFarmer.com next week. But the National Cotton Council today came out with an economic and policy analysis for U.S. cotton in 2018 and 2019. And they took on some economists at Ohio State University and some lawmakers who said, wait a minute, cotton is much better off than other commodities and yada, yada, yada. Well, they took, I think they've done some really excellent analysis to point out that cotton was the only one in getting back into Title I who lost actual base to get there. So they had to get something, and they put out some facts and figures that has given some good common sense to this debate that don't leave cotton out in any trade aspect, because they were significantly impacted by this virtual loss of the Chinese market. So I like when a commodity group comes out punching with facts and figures, and it's a signal that should be heard in Washington.
Will it be heard if there is a, or probably if or when there is a new round of tariff payments?
Well, there's only, again, there's limited funding for that because of the WTO constraints. But Perdue has already said there's going to be some potential changes in the methodology, perhaps the payment rates, et cetera. So I'm not going to rule out some you know, changes here, not only for cotton, but a host of other commodities who felt very, very inefficient that they were not dealt with fairly in the first round.
All right. Well, before we wrap up, Jim, I want to look at a poll we did this week. And I sent this out to our Pulse folks. They send out a mobile phone-based poll, alert people so that they can then go in and vote on it. And I was curious on a couple of things. One, we've seen President Trump have a couple of significant wins here lately with the USMCA agreement and with Kavanaugh making it to the Supreme Court. So I was curious if there was any bump for him there. And then also, we have all this talk in the national media about this midterm election being a referendum on the president. And I was curious if our audience for Ag Web and Farm Journal saw this election that way. And so sent out a Pulse poll. And I was not surprised by the trend in this Pulse poll, but I was surprised by the depth of the support for the president in this. I was expecting a lot of support, but not to this degree. So we asked people in general if the President Trump will influence their votes in the midterm election. Of those that responded, and there was just under 1,000 responses, 62% said yes, they plan to vote for a Republican candidate in order to support President Trump. I was expecting a majority, but I wasn't expecting that much. And just 12% said no, or that they plan to vote for Democrats to oppose the president.
Yeah. Well, it's anecdotal on my part, too. When I go out, and I'm going out next week to a pork industry meeting in Des Moines, Iowa, Tuesday and Wednesday, I hear the same thing from not only farmers, ag industry. I don't see the withdrawal of support because of the trade policy problems, the lower prices, et cetera. And in fact, the approval rating for President Trump has increased since the Kavanaugh hearing, you know, let's call it the Kavanaugh situation, you know, several weeks ago now. But and he's at nearing his highest levels the first week he was in office. I think it's at 47%, still under 50%. But he's actually at or slightly above the level that Obama and Reagan was at this time in their presidency. So, again, being a very different president, I think his the people who voted for him or the people who want significant change in this town called Washington are not leaving him because they know that it's not an easy situation. And I think that's what your poll and what my ear is hearing when I go out to, you know, presentations.
Yeah. And it's not just that they support the president, but I mean, only 26% said that presidential politics don't play or will not play a role in their congressional votes in the midterms. So you've got a very solid majority saying, you know, not only do we support what the president's doing, but we plan to vote for other offices in order to support what he's doing and continuing that effort. And I think that's a pretty strong statement.
Yes, and this is what you hear when if you happen to watch his, you know, Trump's campaign appearances for a host of not only senators, but and he'll be in Texas next Monday, I think. But he drives this home, and I've never seen a president campaign for both Senate and House members the way the president has been doing. And it's like he's up for re-election right now. Of course, he isn't.
But this poll kind of indicates that he is.
Yeah, if they're saying it's a referendum on him, he's not, you know, he's not going away from it. He's hitting it head on. And I think that's what's helping, you know, some of his numbers either going up or at least not going down. I think you're seeing the power of the office right there. And with his megaphone voice and tweets, you're seeing it in gangbusters. Not saying there's no negatives in his policy, but if you want somebody to go for you, he's the kind of guy that you would want on the campaign trail. He doesn't he's not a pansy.
Well, and when it comes down to the midterms, it's going to come down to voter enthusiasm and who gets out to the polls. Again, these things that we've been talking about are a pretty good marker for the president and for the Republicans going into that. Not saying that there's not enthusiasm among the Democrats, but I think I think the Democrats were counting on less enthusiasm for the president and the Republican Party because of the way the president has been acting. And they may be surprised by that come November 6th.
Well, you've got the bipartisan, well-respected Cook Political Report, Charlie Cook's item this week. He said the most dramatic change over the last 6 weeks in the midterm election picture is clearly in the Senate, but the House situation has suddenly, he said, changed as well. Because he said not long ago, the most likely outcome for the Senate was either no net change at all or a shift of maybe one seat. But now he's saying a Republican net gain of a seat or two seems most likely. moving the Republicans up to either 52 or 53 seats. And then on the House side, to really bottom line what he's saying, they still feel that the Democrats remain heavily favored to capture a majority. But now it has blowing the House wide open with a gain of 40 to 50 seats. No. That has changed. So he sees only a net gain of between 20 and 40 seats. Now, they need a net gain of 23 seats to, regain control of the House. So it has a impact. There's no doubt about it. And this is from an expert called Charlie Cook.
Oh, wow. That's some great insight there. Thanks, Jim. Well, what are you going to be watching for signals in the coming week?
Well, we've got food prices next week. I think they should remain very tepid. We've got crop progress is going to be looked at, how much of the crop. I think with these improving Jaron weather, maybe we can get up to snuff in the harvest of this crop. And then we have the always important Thursday export sales report on Thursday. But my key will be not only Saudi Arabia and the geopolitical angles between the U.S. and that country, but also if we get any more solid information on the U.S.-China trade talks on the 29th of November, and if we hear anything about this topic from Bob Lighthizer at the U.S. Trade Rep's office.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Jim Wiesmeyer, who is the D.C. analyst for Pro Farmer. And we got to get into that mention if folks want to get a hold of you and do those speaking appearances out at their events.
My last name at gmail.com. W-I-E-S as in Sam, E-M-E-Y-E-R at gmail.com. I'll see you all in Des Moines at the Hog Industry Conference and coming up, Crop Insurance Agents in South Carolina the following week. And also the following week, I'll be out in Arizona at the Farm Managers and Rural Appraisers meeting.
All right. Like I said, Jim Wiesmeyer from Pro Farmer. I'm John Harith, Farm Journal News Director. And that's this week's D.C. Signal to Noise.